people, welcome to Poetically Laid Bare, the podcast. Today, my guest is Tate Simpson, who is an investor relation guy. So, Tate, thank you for being here. And tell us, what is this investor relation function about? And also, I'm particularly puzzled because when I started in Poetically, it was in the early 2000s, and there was no people with such a job title. And then nowadays, I meet one every 10 people at a conference. So it looks like, you know, there is some demand for it. So tell us more about what it is about and a bit the history of its function.
Yeah, sure. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm sorry we can't do this in person. I was like making it up to Oxford and up to the Private Equity Forum. And when this is all over, you know, I have no doubt we'll do it again. Sure. I started working in investor relations in 2009. I'd graduated from the business school at Oxford in 2007-08. And, you know, as you've well documented, you know, the private equity industry has grown tremendously over the last, let's call it 12 years. It's grown tremendously, since the global financial crisis in 2008, which was a challenging and transformative period for the financial industry. And I think what happened coming out of that crisis is, you know, investors were asking a lot more questions, and the leadership of the private equity firms that existed at that point were not equipped to answer those questions. They hadn't been asked the questions in the past. They were inundated with questions. Some of the portfolio companies that they had were in very difficult positions at the time. And so you were having to provide a lot more information about topics that, you know, were challenging. And one of the success stories of private equity is that the vast majority of private equity owned companies came through that financial crisis, avoided bankruptcy, not all of them, but the vast majority, far more than people thought at the time. And then the industry went on a real tear and proceeded to move into other areas of private markets, whether that's, you know, huge expansion in the amount of growth equity capital, huge expansion in the amount of private lending and private debt, and then, you know, the continued growth of private equity in all of its shapes and forms. And so
does it mean that you're kind of like a helpline worker? So there was no need for helpline workers like before the crisis, and then the crisis hit.
Yeah, there was a lot of
people call you up. This is kind of like the worst job to have, right? Because you receive only complaints from people. You're like,
I agree with that. And that first of all, that period only it lasted for, let's call it a year in the United States and longer than that. But I think what happened when you say helpline, you know, I think all of the organizations, they staffed up, they hired at all levels, you know, the analyst level, the associate level, going up to the senior level. They brought in their finance departments, they brought in their communication departments, they grew those departments so that the quality of information that you get from a private equity firm today is way better than it was 10 years ago and better than it was 5 years ago. And it's not even comparable to 15 years ago. And so the level of transparency and information and the timeliness of the information and the reporting, you know, has really, really grown over that period. And that was, I think, where investor relations started. It then very quickly pivoted, though, to we're going to need to raise successor funds, right? That private equity firms, growth equity firms, venture capital firms, they don't work unless you can raise a successor fund. And so first, you know, there was the, let's call it investor relations, and then there was the business development or fundraising.
But that existed before already, right?
Well, it existed before, but oftentimes it was, you know, the chief financial officer or someone with a legal background who was fielding calls from mostly limited partners that were from the home country. So if you're an American-based private equity firm, you had some American pension plans. If you were a European one and there weren't that many, you know, you had some family offices and European pension plans that you were dealing with, but all of a sudden, you know, the industry went global, right? People wanted to raise capital or were fielding inbound inquiries from Asia, from the Middle East, from new parts of Europe. And you needed people to deal with that. And then the task of raising a new fund was challenging and time consuming. And that was new also to many of these firms.
Okay. And so then it means you have two aspects of your business. You have this helpline one, like handling questions of the investors, and then the one where you need to go and raise funds. And these two things, I suppose, are quite complementary because it's kind of, you know, the difference between giving information on the go when a fund is ongoing, but it's the same sort of information you need to give when you're fundraising anyway. So,
yeah, I personally think they are quite complementary, and firms deal with those in different ways. But I think investors want to talk to people who are very knowledgeable about their investments. And I think for limited partners that have, you know, good and close relationships with private markets firms, let's call them private equity firms, right? It's a hybrid discussion. It's a discussion about what's going on with my existing investments and what should we do about new investments.
And so does that mean that you have to also know what's going on the portfolio extremely well? So you need to go on the ground as well, or it feels a bit detached in a sense from the rest of a firm that is like investment managers, right? And it feels a bit like when you're the marketing department of like a biscuit factory, right? You're the only one not doing biscuits. You are the one doing marketing, but at the same time, you need to answer questions about the biscuits. So, so how much do you do to go and see companies and like to keep yourself informed about all that?
It's first of all, I'm not sure I follow with the biscuits, but, listen, people want to talk to people who are informed and who are also, you know, passionate about why it is you should invest in this particular fund, because funds go off in all sorts of different directions, right? Whether that's energy, whether that's mid-market firms, whether that's growth equity, whether that's firms investing in emerging markets. And so they want to talk to people. And I think in order to be successful, you have to be, you know, up to speed and also passionate, because if you're not passionate and you're not saying, listen, this is really interesting, what's going on in fill in the blank, real estate, debt, energy, emerging markets, then the person listening to you is probably going to say, you know, that doesn't sound like a place I should lock up my capital for 10 years. And I'll pass. Thank you very much. And I'll go into, you know, another area with another manager.
Okay. Does that mean you have a stake also in the funds? Do you personally invest? Like, because for like senior partners in some firms, they are asked to put some of their own money into a fund to prove that, you know, they believe in the things. Do we now see this also for people in investor relations?
Well, I think 2 points. One is, you know, limited partners want to see alignment of interest. And I do actually think that by and large, one of the real strengths of the private equity industry is that alignment of interest. It is far greater than exists in the mutual fund industry and other industries. Managers are investing their own capital, and we can go into what exactly that means, but it's certainly capital coming from, you know, the firm and its employees of anywhere from 2 up to, you know, 7.5, and I've seen higher than that. And, you know, most employees at most firms who have agreed to be there for a long period of time, you know, have the ability or are forced, depending on the nuances of their contract, to invest in the funds and the companies. And that provides, I think, a very good alignment of interest that actually doesn't exist in many other parts of the financial industry.
I'm trying to find out the do's and don'ts for the students who may look into a career in this direction. So one you already said is like to be passionate and to believe in the product, which I guess a corollary of that is that if you do not believe in the firm anymore, you need to change firms. And so maybe you can comment on that one and maybe the other do's and don'ts in this job.
Yeah, listen, I think you absolutely have to like people. It's going to be a real problem if you're in the field. And there are many people in the financial industry who, you know, are more introverted. They prefer to be left by themselves. They're very numerical. They like, again, kind of spending time and by themselves with numbers. That isn't going to work, I don't think, particularly well in the medium to long term in investor relations, although, you know, those people can be very knowledgeable and very successful in other areas. I think the number one don't that I see, and I think it pertains also to people who are just raising capital for a startup, right, or their own startup, their own company, is overconfidence, right? That somehow my idea or my fund is so good that it's going to fly off the shelf, and you're lucky that I'm even speaking to you today. And I know that may sound laughable, but I see that constantly, both personally and professionally. I think you have to acknowledge that this is going to be a lot of work, that you need to take it very seriously. You need to be knowledgeable. You need to be passionate. Some people are going to decline. And when people ultimately do say yes, you have to say thank you. And then you go on this journey with them where you're invested in a private company or a private fund. And that journey is going to be a long one. I'm invested with some classmates from business school with where you teach. I made the investment in 2009. It's now 2021, and we're still talking about the investment. And I think we will be for, a number more years. And I would highlight that group is actually, I think, having done a fairly good job of investor relations. They're not raising a fund, but they are raising money for a company.
Okay. And so some people outsource these functions, right? You like placement agents, these sorts of people seem to be doing these sorts of things. So how does it work? Like, so where you draw the line and which type of firms decide to outsource versus not? And a corollary to that is that when you outsource, you may be able to invoice maybe portfolio companies about this cost. If you keep it in-house, maybe you have to bear the cost. How does that work then? Like, there is a question of like, who pays for this?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any cases where portfolio companies paid. But yeah, absolutely. So if someone is raising capital for a small fund or even, a mid-sized fund or even a large fund, there exists an industry called the placement industry. It's been around for a long time, but again, it has boomed since the last financial crisis. Most of the placement agents sit within boutique investment banks, although some sit within larger investment banks. So for example, UBS has had a placement business for a long time. Credit Suisse has a good one that's been around for a long time. But then most or all now of the boutique investment banks offer this service. And I think it done well offers a lot of value. There are hundreds and hundreds of limited partners out in the world. And it is a competitive industry. It's one that is challenging to get into. And so they provide the guidance on how to do that. Obviously for a fee, but it's a fee that's, I think, definitely worth paying given given what happens if you're not successful, right? Which is you end up spending a year, 2 years attempting to raise money for a company or a fund and you don't get there. In retrospect, you might have wanted to pay, a placement agent to ultimately get you to the goal that you had. And I'm constantly impressed and surprised by the number of first-time funds that get raised in the industry with the help of placement agents.
Sometimes it's said that the placement agents actually give a stamp of approval. So they do their own due diligence and then they say, okay, this firm is worth investing in. It feels like it's a third party that says yes. They do have a bit of conflicts because they want also the money, but still. But in your case, you are working for that firm. You are never going to say that it is not a good thing. So it feels that there is one layer higher of scrutiny when it's a placement agent bringing up the fund than if you do it internally, because of course you're going to give your story. Is that fair?
So most of the major private equity firms, or all of them, have by and large entirely gone in-house with their fundraising for a whole variety of reasons. And I think it's been a fairly happy parting of the ways. I think that the placement agents prefer to work on first or second time funds, smaller funds, and the larger groups have insourced this function for a variety of reasons. It is true that some of the better placement agents, if they agree to work with you, it is somewhat of a stamp of approval because they don't want to take on projects that are going to be a lot of work and not successful. because they get paid mostly on a success basis. So there's a bias there. They want to work with the best up and coming managers because they want the quickest path to, you know, ultimately that group having success, which means they have financial success, and then they can move on to the next project. And ideally, you know, that relationship can go on for a while. You know, placement agents can work with managers, not just on one fund, but on successor funds. And the exact nature of the relationship, you know, will change over time.
I think I'm going to give you two examples of recent MBA students. One said, you know, they come in when they're around 30, right? So they had sometimes a career in their 20s and they come to change career. So here are two examples. One says, I was a model when I was 20. I come to do an MBA. So now
a fashion model.
And then another guy comes in and say, you know, I was a professional rugby player and now I need to change career, right? And these two students, which is just last year students, they said, you know, and I want to go to private equity. Okay, I went through your course and then this is the industry to be. So I want to go to private equity as my next step. And I say, but, you know, I'm not a finance person. I'm not, you know, I'm not an ex-consultant or anything like that. And so I'm thinking about trying to get into investor relations because I'm good at people and I, you know, I'm good. And then, you know, maybe from there, I will be able to do what I really want to do, which is, you know, managing companies and things like that, which is, you know, the investing job. Do you think this is a good reasoning? Is it, can we see your position as a way to go towards managing investments? Or is that a bad way of thinking about it?
I don't think that's a realistic career path, the one that you just described, just knowing how the industry works. What I would say is I've seen a number of people who were doing the investor relations function. And you have to remember that there were very few people in investor relations pre-2007. So most people have a background that isn't cookie cutter because there was no cookie cutter. And so, you know, I know a number of people that have been successful in the industry that have backgrounds as lawyers, you know, for example. And then as firms have grown, the number of people in non-investing roles has grown massively, right? And those parts of the business can be interesting as well. They also require management. And so I know a number of people that have sort of started out in investor relations and moved into management, you know, roles in private markets firms. But, you know, I think if what you really are passionate about is working on the new portfolio companies, the new investments, you know, you need to find a different path. One of the most impressive people, I think, actually to come out of the Saïd Business School is a woman who wanted to get into private equity. She came from a little bit more of an operations background. She got an operations role. I think it was kind of a part-time role with a private equity firm that was just starting out. They just, again, hired a placement agent to raise their first firm. She went in-house. They liked her. They made an investment in a famous Canadian clothing company. That company fell on some hard times. She was working full-time for the portfolio company. They decided they wanted to make a management change. She is now, I think, the youngest female CEO of a name brand company in Canada. And, you know, I think that's a very interesting career path that she's taken to a very interesting place.
But then she started in
operations for with a private equity, which is another part of the private equity industry, which we could talk about, but is not the subject for today.
So that does mean that for you personally, that you wouldn't consider moving towards an investment position. You would see yourself as staying on that side of a business, or are you tempted to look into investing?
I'm quite happy with what I'm doing. It checks a lot of boxes of both what I'm interested in and what I'm good at. But I would say, again, the industry is evolving fast, right? And so the skill set that you need as an investment professional is changing, right? You look at all of the investments that are going on today in technology, right? And the ability to diligence those assets, that's kind of it's a different skill set than I think the one that the vast majority of private equity managers had 10 years ago. Meaningfully different. Not totally different, but meaningfully different.
because it's much more technical, you mean? So they would need things are much,
it's much more technical. You're more looking technical. At different, you're looking at different metrics. The companies are growing much faster. It's not, you're not simply buying private market cash flows with many of these new technology companies.
Yeah. And so in fact, the managers, the fund managers of the 2000s are maybe now, in fact, de facto more like investor relations type of people because
they're still leading the private equity firms, but they, and many of them are still investing in, you know, more old economy cash flowing businesses, but there's been this massive growth in investing in technology, which has been, you know, highly profitable for the managers and for the limited partners. But, you know, the way in which you analyze one of those investments is different.
Okay. Any what kind of advice would you give to MBA students or knowledge that you find they are often missing or things that they, you know, they have some preconception about private equity and that, you know, is not true? Like anything that you'd like to tell students?
I would think as it relates to the subject that we're discussing today, kind of fundraising and investor relations, I think that it's something you have to spend some time trying to understand and get your head around, because whether you're in the field or not, it's something you're going to have to know a little bit about. If you, and I see this frequently, right, you're going to start your own company and you have to raise capital. I mean, one of the key aspects, factors of whether your venture is going to be successful is your ability to fundraise. If you can raise $50 million for your new startup, you've got years of runway to go to hire people to expand. If you can't raise any money, you're very quickly going to run out of money and, you know, have to declare bankruptcy. And so you may not think of yourself as a fundraiser or someone in investor relations, but, you know, your ability to fundraise is going to be a key determinant of whether your venture is successful or whether your startup fund is successful, or I think increasingly at, not for everybody, but for many of the senior professionals or even mid-level professionals at private equity firms, you have to be able to articulate what you're doing and aid in the overall, you know, fundraising process. So it may not be the field for you. I'm not advocating it certainly for everybody, but to dismiss it is the wrong way to go about it, because it's going to be relevant in your career at some point. I think, you know, if you're in the any part of, you know, investing in companies, raising capital for companies, investing in funds, raising capital for funds.
Yeah, I would actually go further. I would say it's even the number one thing, because what we see at our university, like in many others, that we see students coming up with all kinds of ideas for businesses, and especially people that are like engineering departments and so on.
Totally.
And they are like, look how cool my idea is. Yep. And you're like, why would I invest in that? Well, just look how cool my idea is. And so they just focus. They think that if the idea is really cool, it's just like the money will come. Like there is there is no next step. There's not something in between.
No, and I'm you know, in my, you know, friends from business school or whatnot, friends of friends, you know, I'm aware of two ideas that fit exactly the description you just made, right? Look at this great idea that I've come up with, you know, and then it becomes awkward as the months go on and they aren't able to close on capital commitments. And the capital commitments for a company and a fund, they don't look all that different, right? It's a subscription document. It's a legal document. We didn't talk about that aspect of it, but there are far more similarities there than differences.
Yeah. And about the data that you provide to investors, what this big evolution indeed, right? 2008 was a major change where investors suddenly became a lot more hands-on and said, you know, we need a lot more information and the like, to the point where actually there is too much information now to process. I'm on an investment committee. If I open the portal of one GP we are in, I'm just drowning on information. I think I know quite well the type of information, and I'm just drowning in it. And so there is all these talks about, you know, making it, you know, comparable from one GP to the other, so that everybody can just like put it all in one database and so on. There are some people working on that. Do you have any comments about this area? Because it seems that, well, that's great, you're giving a lot of information, but if I cannot process it, it's as if you don't give me any, because I just cannot read it.
Yeah, I think that's where good limited partners come in to the discussion. You know, a very good limited partner will be able to look at that data, even or and it's not just data, it's documents and PPMs and subscription documents and track records and presentations and portfolio company slides, and very quickly sift through that and determine, you know, what are my key questions and what information are they not giving me, right? And then you can have a very focused discussion around that. But that's a hard stage to get to. And you're right that there has been an element of like, we're not sure what information you're looking for, so here's all of it. So, but managers are providing a lot of information, and it's up to kind of savvy investors to read through it and
Yeah,
actually
but that's
here's
difficult. But
it is difficult. It is difficult.
there could be the industry associations could create, common template saying here is like 100 columns. Everybody needs to fill them in. Then investors can
Yeah,
compare across fund managers. It's just
but
then otherwise you just cannot do anything with all of this.
it is challenging. I agree with you. I think just a lot of the metrics don't line up, right? So an energy private equity firm that's buying acreage in the Permian Basin, and you're asking them to compare their, you know, the metrics that are important to them to a fast-growing software company in Eastern Europe, that a lot of the metrics don't even line up, right? Both companies would have no EBITDA, but could be very promising investments. And so it's going to be, and there is a move, and we provide a lot of information and we work on those templates, but there's just a lot of different kinds of managers out there too.
Yeah, but at least some could be comparable. Like an LPA could be boiled down to like 50 sales, and then everybody fills the 50 sales or things like that. All of
Yep.
this could really help. Same with reporting of fees, right? You do have some minimum
Yeah, and
like.
that's a good example of where the industry has come a long way, right? Disclosure and simplification and removing certain types of
Yeah, but
fees.
it seems to be mainly the ILPA pushing, and it does look like a number of GPs don't really want to adopt the ILPA template for fee reporting, for example, or you don't see it that way.
I don't have a huge, I mean, I know what the ILPA template is, but I don't, by and large, I've seen managers adopt it, but I've, to be fair, worked for larger managers that have a lot of resources. I could certainly see a small manager say, I simply don't have the resources to comply with ILPA, right? I've got 15 people that work for me. We make two or three portfolio company investments a year in a particular sector. You know, I just don't, I can't fill this template out.
And so you say that the larger private equity firms are adopting ILPA templates for like fee reporting and the like?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. And the last question maybe is around the reputation generally of private equity. Is that something that you have to deal with? Like when you have portfolio companies that may be firing people or people who are concerned about, ESG, generally speaking, like impact on stakeholders. Is that a big part of your job to look at all the stakeholders so you report about it? And so can you comment about that aspect of the job?
So I think there's two elements to that. So there's the reputation of the private equity industry. It's hard to paint with one brush, right? So, you know, when I was hanging around the BVCA meetings in, call it the 2010 to 2015 period, I mean, two of the leading people were John Moulton and Guy Hans, and their type of private equity versus what, you know, some of these international firms are doing, whether it's Hellman & Friedman or Blackstone or Advent. They're just really not comparable. And so to paint that whole industry with one brush, you know, I think is hard. Certainly there have been some managers that have misbehaved, but I think most managers are trying, you know, to do a good job for their limited partners who are their key stakeholders. The industry has lots of characters to it and lots of different parts. I think it's tough to paint with one brush. What I would say is, you know, there's continues to be a massive need for private capital and private companies, and that's the momentum the industry has, right? I mean, let's look at the largest sector of the global economy today, software. 99% of all software companies are private. So where's the money going to come to fund those companies? It has to come from private sources, and it could be directly from pension plans, but again, they're looking for partners, and so it's going to come from private markets. ESG is something slightly different. That is, you know, massively exploded, for lack of a better word, over the last 24 months. and it just continues to snowball and is something that's really interesting and managers are working on and trying to do their best and know that it's important to limited partners. It's a big, again, it's hard to paint with one brush, right? There's, you know, for example, I know, you know, one set of limited partners, they're very, very focused on labor issues, you know, and union issues, right? Others, it's much more environmental. You know, there's moves around inclusion and diversity. I mean, all of these issues are important and it's a really large field and managers are devoting a ton of time and resources to that. And it'll be for the better in the industry, but everyone's, you know, working hard on it from the limited partner and the GP partner. There's a lot of conversations going on. I think both sides are learning a little bit from each other. And that movement will just continue.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Do you have any last thing for the students to have to know?
I have to know. I mean, there's tons of interesting classes at your business school. I think all of them, you know, were a real interest to me, whether it was entrepreneurial finance, you know, private equity, venture capital. They have a lot of similarities as it relates to how you raise capital, the importance of raising capital, you know, some of the do's and don'ts. And, you know, as you hit on, I don't want to say it's the number one most important thing, but it is a major factor in the success that you're going to have as a company or as a private market investor.
Okay, fantastic. So Tate, thank you so much for having done this. I'm sure everybody has learned a lot. This was Investor Relations Laid Bare. Don't forget to subscribe and to rate it if you liked it. Congratulations on your acquisition of one more piece of knowledge. Ciao, ciao. 'That's it.
Well, there you go. And then where does that go?
Everywhere. So it's going everywhere. So I